This is an Alela netcast of the Mishnah Leadership Conversation with Alan Roxburgh that took place in Toronto on March 19th, 2007. This is part one. The netcast was recorded and edited by Jared Siebert for the co-sponsor of the event, Resonate. Visit the Resonate site at resonate.ca. The evening was hosted and emceed by Daryl Dash at Richview Baptist Church in Toronto. This netcast begins just after the viewing of the Alela netcast video, Reaching a New Generation Revisited, a tale of three churches in a New Age mall. This video can be viewed on the Alela site. And if you're listening to this netcast online, please take a few moments to watch that video as it puts the beginning of the evening in context. If you're listening to this netcast as a podcast subscription within iTunes, click on the link in the graphics track.
How do you be God's people in the local places where you find yourself? And let me frame some things briefly for you. I actually haven't been in Toronto except when planes touch down and take off. Probably for about 15 to 18 years. And so I don't know a lot about the Toronto scene, and I don't pretend that I do. I do remember when I was in Toronto for about 9 years, when with some of you in this room, there were some incredible networks of conversations among churches and church leaders. And for me, it was a generative, exciting, energizing time. And so I have deep and fun memories of Toronto, but I do must confess that my dear wife has said to me that I can move anywhere I want on my own. And so Vancouver is home, which is not a bad place to be, since that's where God lives in the winter. And but here's some things I would like to say, and then let's just have some conversation. God is up to something in ordinary local churches. My work takes me across the United States. I work in very large denominational systems and with multiple kinds of local churches. I also work in the United Kingdom with a whole variety of churches there, as well as Australia and New Zealand. And so I have an opportunity, and I take it as a great gift that God has given me, to see what is going on the ground. And one of the things I want to say tonight is that amongst ordinary people in these God-forsaken places we call local churches, God is at work. And it's important for me to say that for a variety of reasons. We all know and don't need any long conversations about the fact that all of us are part of massive culture shifts in the modern West. And those culture shifts are set up in all kinds of ways. We call it late modernity, postmodernity, globalization, pluralization, whatever words you want, we know it's going on. And we've had those conversations for quite a while. And there's been all kinds of both awkward and elegant attempts to work with this. And so we've had all kinds of programs out there for the church, programs in how-to, programs that leaders go to conferences or buy off the shelves, ways of putting the church back together again in the way it was. We've also had and still have lots of movements that are basically saying the existing, and these are the words that get used, institutional organized church is basically had it. And so you can read books now that speak about the death of the church. And out of that, there are all kinds of experiments which, whether you use big E or little e, go under the language of emergent or emerging, that are seeking to find new alternative ways of being the church. And so for 20 years or more, there's been all this flux going on. There have been movements within denominational systems to ask, how do we stop the spinning? And how do we find ways of repopulating our churches? Most of the time, what happens is that leaders go look for programs. And often they go south of the border or across the Atlantic or somewhere else, in the assumption that if you can find a program or a great leader, you can bring them into your denomination or your church, and you can turn things around. The problem with those notions is that they are fundamentally denying what God's up to in the world. And what they do as a deep element of modernity is say to ordinary people in ordinary churches, you folk are just laity, idiots. You have no idea how to engage the changing culture with the gospel. So here's a program from Germany. Here's something from the United States. Here's this thing. Let's do this. And so there's little expectation in our churches that in and amongst ourselves we can understand and imagine and experiment around the life of the Spirit of God in our communities. At the same time, you get all these new experiments. And many of these new experiments, and some of these guys and gals are my friends, are essentially believing that there's no hope left, really, in organized, established churches. In the United States, let me not pick on Canada, I have lots of friends who think that church planting is the answer. And the reason they think church planting is the answer is because they don't see much hope coming from existing churches, so we plant new ones. I tell my American friends that when you do that, you're just living out your own myth. Their myth is that you can leave one country, come to another, and start with a clean page and start all over again. And I keep telling my friends, you can never do that. And so, what I have been looking for and been a part of, and what I'm seeing, is a whole movement of small, local, ordinary churches rediscovering gospel and missional life. I'll tell you a couple of stories and then give you an illustration. But here's what I've become convinced of. And it's about rereading Scripture. That the God who encounters us in Jesus Christ is a God who, not my plan, always turns up in the most God-forsaken places. And if you want to know where God is, look in the most God-forsaken places. That's where God's future always emerges. And so these days, I look around and I say, where are the most God-forsaken places? And most of the time, if I listen to people, they're congregations in existing churches. And I go, that's where God's future is going to pop up. The second thing is that there is this, and let me just do this and I'll tell a story and then I'll stop. There is in Luke Acts this drama going on. And it goes like this. We get towards the end of the first century, and the most of the church now are small dispersed Christian groups, and they're Gentile. And they're looking back over the first century, you know, 80s, late 80s on, and there's a basic question going on amongst these Gentile Christians. And basically the question is, what went wrong? How come it hasn't turned out the way you promised us? I.e., Jerusalem, you said, was going to be the place where when the Lord returned, all the nations of the earth are going to come back and worship. Well, Jerusalem doesn't exist anymore, neither does the temple. And the very people of God no longer want us as part of them, and we don't see Rome bending any knee. And guess what? It's not very nice out here in the hinterland. What went wrong? And so Luke writes this Luke Acts to say a number of things. One of the things he's saying, particularly in Acts, is simply this. This is actually God at work. If you read back into the Jewish scriptures and you look, here's what you discover. That the work of the Spirit of God, by and large, is always to disrupt the comfortable places to which we've arrived. And the story of the book of Acts is basically this. Each time the church thought it had Jesus figured out and created its own boundaries of what that looked like, the Spirit of God would break in and break those boundaries because the imagination of what God was about was greater than and bigger than anything that they had imagined. So that's one of the things that Luke is saying. that the disruptiveness, the sense of things haven't worked out the way we expected, expect that. That's how the Spirit of God works, breaking the boundaries that we create. Second thing of many things that Luke does takes place in Luke 10. Remember the story in Luke 10 of Jesus sending the 70, out by twos to go to every place where he was about to go, into the towns and the villages. And when they went into those towns and villages, he said, don't take this with you, don't take that with you, don't speak to people on the road, but do this. Luke, I think, is saying something to these Christians that we need to hear. They're asking, what is God up to? It hasn't turned out the way we thought. What is God up to? Here's what I think Luke is saying to them in Luke 10. You will never know what God is up to. You will have no idea what God is doing until you leave the safety and the confines of your locations. To use the language of some of my emergent friends, attractional churches ain't where it's at, folks. You'll never discover what God's up to if you have attractional churches. You've got to risk entering the neighborhoods, the places where you live, not as those in control and in power, but you've got to go and be welcomed into the houses of the other. This is the reversal of we offer them. That you become the stranger who is welcomed and you sit at their table and you enter their narratives. I think Luke is saying you'll never figure out what God's up to until that becomes the rhythm and the environment and the way of life that you practice. Now, there's more going on, but that's what he's saying. The second question that gets asked is, what does it mean to be the church in this strange new place where we find ourselves? And I think in Luke 10, Luke is saying again, you will never figure out what it means to be the church by going to conferences, listening to experts, or calling in great leaders from somewhere else to lead you. You will only figure out what it means to be the church if you enter the neighborhoods and the communities where you live and you sit at the table of the other as a guest and enter into their narratives and stories. It is only in that context that you will begin to discover locally and particularly what it means to be the people of God in that place. A story which you can pick up on the podcast and connect with this. A friend of mine, his name is Steve Taylor, as Bill has mentioned. Steve lives in Christchurch, New Zealand, and he is one of the leaders of a Baptist church. He always laughs at me when I say this. It's called Opua Baptist Church. Let me tell you about Steve. Steve is in his early 40s, and about 8 years ago, in Auckland, New Zealand, he started an emergent church. And this emergent church grew. And what Steve discovered as his emergent church grew is that it actually took on all the problems of all the other kinds of churches as it grew. But here's what Steve discovered. He discovered that, now he's a member of the Baptist Union of New Zealand. And I can say this because once upon a time in another life, I was a Baptist. And so all of his fellow pastors in the Baptist Union said to him, well, Steve, if we went and planted a new church like this and started, we could do what you did. In other words, they were able to discount what he was doing because, quote, it was new and different and not like what they had to work with. Now, Steve, who's a missionary's kid, loves the church. And so he did this crazy thing. He said, I'm never going to change the church from outside. So what he did is he applied for the position of senior pastor. It had got down to 60 people. Of Opawa Baptist Church in Christchurch. This, once upon a time, was the flagship church of the denomination. When I drove into this place, it's at the back end of a suburb. You know, can't get more God-forsaken than that. And, you know, it's one of these classic kind of 50s, 60s churches. Remember when they were building suburbs and the builders had to sort of set aside a plot of land to put on a church? And what you did back then is you did your demographics and you said, in a suburb this big, this percentage will be Baptist, this percentage will be, yeah, we can put in a church. And so they built a church. And now, of course, in the beginning of the second millennium, this church is now down to about 60 people. It had basically created a lot of pain for its last three pastors who were leaving. And so Steve applied to this church. And all of his pastoral colleagues said to him, "You gotta be stupid. Why would you go to a church like that? It'll ruin your career. You can't win." So Steve goes in, and he begins to live in the midst of the narratives of those people. And he does things that they expect. He preaches. He leads worship services. Now, he brings a lot of his emergent stuff into that. But he just lives in the midst of their narratives. He tells a story. It's a gorgeous story when you listen to it, of meeting with some of the people there. And the first time he met them, he brings an egg, a raw egg, with him. And he sits amongst them, and he opens his hand with this raw egg, and he said, "You're probably feeling like this egg right now, pretty fragile. Well, so am I. And I'm not here because I got a big plan for you." So he pitches his tent beside theirs, and he lives at their tables, and he listens to their stories and narratives. And out of those stories and narratives, things start to emerge. For example, some of them start to say, "You know, we hang out in this coffee shop, and there are..." Now, this is kind of just a regular, ordinary, God-forsaken congregation. "And there are people in the coffee shop who are really interested in spirituality. And as Steve began to sit with them, they thought, why don't we start something like a spiritual journeying group in the coffee shop?" And you can listen to this. It becomes a little house church. Another group begins to say, "You know, wow." And they begin to think of things. And what begins to pop up are all about 8 or 9 what we would call house churches connected. They come together to worship in all kinds of ways. When I was there, it was just before Christmas this past year, and on the back of the lot of this church were all these... You know the big containers they put on the back of trucks? You know, great big containers on the back of trucks, about, you know, 10 feet wide and 15, 18 feet high and 30 or 40 feet long. It was about 8 of them in the back of the lot. Well, some artists had started to come to the church. And this church, in its tradition, would always have a kind of a Christmas creche at the front of the church to invite people to come to their Christmas Eve services and that kind of thing. It had become pretty clear that that was probably a huge waste of time. But Steve said, let's live into that story. What were we doing? And as they lived into and honored the story of their past, here's what began to emerge. Instead of us trying to get them to come to us, why don't we take the Christmas story to them? And here's what they did. In Christchurch, there's a tram line. Remember, this is New Zealand, so, you know, not a big country. In Christchurch, there's a tram line that runs around the interior of the city. They went to the city council, not Steve, they went to the city council, and they said, we would like to offer Christmas to the city. And what they did is, with artists, all kinds of artists, and others joined us, they created different scenes of the Christmas story inside these containers. Gorgeous stuff. I watched them. And they placed them at tram stops around the city. And then they provided people with passes so that they could go around and connect with the Christmas story. Now, what's the point? I mean, that's not going to change the world. The point is, what Steve was doing with others, it's not just him, was entering the stories of the people in that church. Not trying to tell them what they should be. Not trying to create a big strategic plan and align everything around it. But entering their stories. And discovers that when you enter the stories of people in these churches, Spirit of God is there. And his imagination. Now it takes skill and work to call forth that imagination. But it starts to come forth. And this is one illustration of what they were up to. What I want to say to you is, I am seeing that happen all over the place. Ordinary churches discovering that amongst themselves, in their own particular ways, the Spirit of God is there. And therefore, God's future is there amongst them. Last week, I met in a Benedictine monastery about 80 miles out of Kansas City with a group of disciples of Christ. Now, if you want to meet a mainline denomination that's fallen down the hole of irrelevance, go meet the disciples of Christ in the United States. But here's the gorgeous thing. About 20 of these people, almost all of them lay people, in a room together, and the imagining and the dreaming that was coming out of them for who they were and what they could be in that place would have stunned you. That's what's giving me energy. It's watching this take place and watching God at work in the local and the particular. Not through experts, not through external programs, but through what the Spirit does in the most God-forsaken places. And I think I don't want to say anymore, and we can have some conversation.
This is an Alelon netcast of the Missional Leadership Conversation with Alan Roxburgh that took place in Toronto on March 19th, 2007. This is part one. The netcast was recorded and edited by Jared Siebert for the co-sponsor of the event, Resonate. Visit the Resonate site at resonate.ca. The evening was hosted and emceed by Daryl Dash at Richview Baptist Church in Toronto. This netcast begins just after the viewing of the Alelon netcast video, Reaching a New Generation Revisited, a tale of three churches in a New Age mall. This video can be viewed on the Alelon site. And if you're listening to this netcast online, please take a few moments to watch that video as it puts the beginning of the evening in context. If you're listening to this netcast as a podcast subscription within iTunes, click on the link in the graphics track.
How do you be God's people in the local places where you find yourself? And let me frame some things briefly for you. I actually haven't been in Toronto except when planes touch down and take off, probably for about 15 to 18 years. And so I don't know a lot about the Toronto scene, and I don't pretend that I do. I do remember when I was in Toronto for about 9 years, when with some of you in this room, there were some incredible networks of conversations among churches and church leaders. And for me, it was a generative, exciting, energizing time. And so I have deep and fond memories of Toronto, but I do must confess that my dear wife has said to me that I can move anywhere I want on my own. And so Vancouver is home, which is not a bad place to be, since that's where God lives in the winter. And but here's some things I would like to say, and then let's just have some conversation. God is up to something in ordinary local churches. My work takes me across the United States. I work in very large denominational systems and with multiple kinds of local churches. I also work in the United Kingdom with a whole variety of churches there, as well as Australia and New Zealand. And so I have an opportunity, and I take it as a great gift that God has given me, to see what is going on the ground. And one of the things I want to say tonight is that amongst ordinary people in these God-forsaken places we call local churches, God is at work. And it's important for me to say that for a variety of reasons. We all know and don't need any long conversations about the fact that all of us are part of massive culture shifts in the modern West. And those culture shifts are set up in all kinds of ways. We call it late modernity, postmodernity, globalization, pluralization, whatever words you want, we know it's going on. And we've had those conversations for quite a while. And there's been all kinds of both awkward and elegant attempts to work with this. And so we've had all kinds of programs out there for the church, programs in how-to, programs that leaders go to conferences or buy off the shelves, ways of putting the church back together again in the way it was. We've also had and still have lots of movements that are basically saying the existing, and these are the words that get used, institutional, organized church is basically had it. And so you can read books now that speak about the death of the church. And out of that, there are all kinds of experiments, which, whether you use big E or little e, go under the language of emergent or emerging, that are seeking to find new alternative ways of being the church. And so for 20 years or more, there's been all this flux going on. There have been movements within denominational systems to ask, how do we stop the spinning? And how do we find ways of repopulating our churches? Most of the time, what happens is that leaders go look for programs. And often they go south of the border or across the Atlantic or somewhere else, in the assumption that if you can find a program or a great leader, you can bring them into your denomination or your church and you can turn things around. The problem with those notions is that they are fundamentally denying what God's up to in the world. And what they do as a deep element of modernity is say to ordinary people in ordinary churches, you folk are just laity, idiots. You have no idea how to engage the changing culture with the gospel. So here's a program from Germany. Here's something from the United States. Here's this thing. Let's do this. And so there's little expectation in our churches that in and amongst ourselves, we can understand and imagine and experiment around the life of the Spirit of God in our communities. At the same time, you get all these new experiments. And many of these new experiments, and some of these guys and gals are my friends, are essentially believing that there's no hope left, really, in organized, established churches. In the United States, let me not pick on Canada, I have lots of friends who think that church planting is the answer. And the reason they think church planting is the answer is because they don't see much hope coming from existing churches, so we plant new ones. I tell my American friends that when you do that, you're just living out your own myth. Their myth is that you can leave one country, come to another, and start with a clean page and start all over again. And I keep telling my friends, you can never do that. And so, what I have been looking for and been a part of, and what I'm seeing, is a whole movement of small, local, ordinary churches rediscovering gospel and missional life. I'll tell you a couple of stories and then give you an illustration. But here's what I've become convinced of. And it's about rereading Scripture. That the God who encounters us in Jesus Christ is a God who, not my plan, always turns up in the most God-forsaken places. And if you want to know where God is, look in the most God-forsaken places. That's where God's future always emerges. And so these days, I look around and I say, where are the most God-forsaken places? And most of the time, if I listen to people, they're congregations in existing churches. And I go, that's where God's future is going to pop up. The second thing is that there is this, and let me just do this, and I'll tell a story, and then I'll stop. There is, in Luke Acts, this drama going on. And it goes like this. We get towards the end of the first century, and most of the church now are small, dispersed Christian groups, and they're Gentile. And they're looking back over the first century, you know, 80s, late 80s, on, and there's a basic question going on amongst these Gentile Christians. And basically the question is, what went wrong? How come it hasn't turned out the way you promised us? I.e., Jerusalem, you said, was going to be the place where, when the Lord returned, all the nations of the earth are going to come back and worship. Well, Jerusalem doesn't exist anymore, neither does the temple. And the very people of God no longer want us as part of them, and we don't see Rome bending any knee. And guess what? It's not very nice out here in the hinterland. What went wrong? And so Luke writes this Luke Acts to say a number of things. One of the things he's saying, particularly in Acts, is simply this. This is actually God at work. If you read back into the Jewish scriptures and you look, here's what you discover. That the work of the Spirit of God, by and large, is always to disrupt the comfortable places to which we've arrived. And the story of the book of Acts is basically this. Each time the church thought it had Jesus figured out and created its own boundaries of what that looked like, the Spirit of God would break in and break those boundaries because the imagination of what God was about was greater than and bigger than anything that they had imagined. So that's one of the things that Luke is saying, that the disruptiveness, the sense of things haven't worked out the way we expected, expect that. That's how the Spirit of God works, breaking the boundaries that we create. Second thing of many things that Luke does takes place in Luke 10. Remember the story in Luke 10 of Jesus sending the 70, in Luke 10 it's the 70, out by twos to go to every place where he was about to go, into the towns and the villages. And when they went into those towns and villages, he said, don't take this with you, don't take that with you, don't speak to people on the road, but do this. Luke, I think, is saying something to these Christians that we need to hear. They're asking, what is God up to? It hasn't turned out the way we thought. What is God up to? Here's what I think Luke is saying to them in Luke 10. You will never know what God is up to. You will have no idea what God is doing until you leave the safety and the confines of your locations. To use the language of some of my emergent friends, attractional churches ain't where it's at, folks. You'll never discover what God's up to if you have attractional churches. You've got to risk entering the neighborhoods, the places where you live, not as those in control and in power, but you've got to go and be welcomed into the houses of the other. This is the reversal of we offer them, that you become the stranger who is welcomed, and you sit at their table, and you enter their narrative. I think Luke is saying, you'll never figure out what God's up to until that becomes the rhythm and the environment and the way of life that you practice. Now, there's more going on, but that's what he's saying. The second question that gets asked is, what does it mean to be the church in this strange new place where we find ourselves? And I think in Luke 10, Luke is saying again, you will never figure out what it means to be the church by going to conferences, listening to experts, or calling in great leaders from somewhere else to lead you. You will only figure out what it means to be the church if you enter the neighborhoods and the communities where you live, and you sit at the table of the other as a guest and enter into their narratives and stories. It is only in that context that you will begin to discover locally and particularly what it means to be the people of God in that place. A story which you can pick up on the podcast and connect with this. A friend of mine, his name is Steve Taylor, as Bill has mentioned. Steve lives in Christchurch, New Zealand, and he is one of the leaders of a Baptist church. He always laughs at me when I say this. It's called Opua Baptist Church. Let me tell you about Steve. Steve is in his early 40s, and about 8 years ago, in Auckland, New Zealand, he started an emergent church. And this emergent church grew. And what Steve discovered as his emergent church grew is that it actually took on all the problems of all the other kinds of churches as it grew. But here's what Steve discovered. He discovered that, now he's a member of the Baptist Union of New Zealand. And I can say this because once upon a time in another life, I was a Baptist. And so all of his fellow pastors in the Baptist Union said to him, "Well, Steve, if we went and planted a new church like this and started, we could do what you did." In other words, they were able to discount what he was doing because, quote, it was new and different and not like what they had to work with. Now, Steve, who's a missionary's kid, loves the church. And so he did this crazy thing. He said, "I'm never going to change the church from outside." So what he did is he applied for the position of senior pastor. It had got down to 60 people. Of Opua Baptist Church in Christchurch. This, once upon a time, was the flagship church of the denomination. When I drove into this place, it's at the back end of a suburb. You know, can't get more God-forsaken than that. And, you know, it's one of these classic kind of 50s, 60s churches. Remember when they were building suburbs and the builders had to sort of set aside a plot of land to put on a church? And what you did back then is you did your demographics and you said, in a suburb this big, this percentage will be Baptist, this percentage will be, yeah, we can put in a church. And so they built a church. And now, of course, in the beginning of the second millennium, this church is now down to about 60 people. It had basically created a lot of pain for its last three pastors who were leaving. And so Steve applied to this church. And all of his pastoral colleagues said to him, "You gotta be stupid. Why would you go to a church like that? It'll ruin your career. You can't win." So Steve goes in and he begins to live in the midst of the narratives of those people. And he does things that they expect. He preaches. He leads worship services. Now he brings a lot of his emergent stuff into that. But he just lives in the midst of their narratives. He tells a story. It's a gorgeous story when you listen to it, of meeting with some of the people there. And the first time he met them, he brings an egg, a raw egg, with him. And he sits amongst them, and he opens his hand with this raw egg, and he said, "You're probably feeling like this egg right now, pretty fragile. Well, so am I. And I'm not here because I got a big plan for you." So he pitches his tent beside theirs, and he lives at their tables, and he listens to their stories and narratives. And out of those stories and narratives, things start to emerge. For example, some of them start to say, "You know, we hang out in this coffee shop, and there are..." Now, this is kind of just a regular, ordinary, God-forsaken congregation. "And there are people in the coffee shop who are really interested in spirituality. And as Steve began to sit with them, they thought, why don't we start something like a spiritual journeying group in the coffee shop. And you can listen to this. It becomes a little house church. Another group begins to say, you know, wow. And they begin to think of things. And what begins to pop up are all about 8 or 9 what we would call house churches connected. They come together to worship in all kinds of ways. When I was there, it was just before Christmas this past year, and on the back of the lot of this church were all these, you know the big containers they put on the back of trucks? You know, great big containers on the back of trucks about, you know, 10 feet wide and 15, 18 feet high and 30 or 40 feet long. It was about 8 of them in the back of the lot. Well, some artists had started to come to the church. And this church, in its tradition, would always have a kind of a Christmas creche at the front of the church to invite people to come to their Christmas Eve services and that kind of thing. It had become pretty clear that that was probably a huge waste of time. But Steve said, let's live into that story. What were we doing? And as they lived into and honored the story of their past, here's what began to emerge. Instead of us trying to get them to come to us, why don't we take the Christmas story to them? And here's what they did. In Christchurch, there's a tram line. Remember, this is New Zealand, so, you know, not a big country. In Christchurch, there's a tram line that runs around the interior of the city. They went to the city council, not Steve, they went to the city council, and they said, we would like to offer Christmas to the city. And what they did is, with artists, all kinds of artists, and others joined us, they created different scenes of the Christmas story inside these containers. Gorgeous stuff, I watched them. And they placed them at tram stops around the city. And then they provided people with passes so that they could go around and connect with the Christmas story. Now, what's the point? I mean, that's not going to change the world. The point is, what Steve was doing with others, it's not just him, was entering the stories of the people in that church. Not trying to tell them what they should be. Not trying to create a big strategic plan and align everything around it. But entering their stories. And discovers that when you enter the stories of people in these churches, Spirit of God is there. And his imagination. Now it takes skill and work to call forth that imagination. But it starts to come forth. And this is one illustration of what they were up to. What I want to say to you is, I am seeing that happen all over the place. Ordinary churches discovering that amongst themselves, in their own particular ways, the Spirit of God is there. And therefore, God's future is there amongst them. Last week, I met in a Benedictine monastery about 80 miles out of Kansas City with a group of disciples of Christ. Now, if you want to meet a mainline denomination that's fallen down the whole of irrelevance, go meet the disciples of Christ in the United States. But here's the gorgeous thing. About 20 of these people, almost all of them lay people, in a room together, and the imagining and the dreaming that was coming out of them for who they were and what they could be in that place would have stunned you. That's what's giving me energy. It's watching this take place and watching God at work in the local and the particular. Not through experts, not through external programs, but through what the Spirit does in the most God-forsaken places. And I think I don't want to say anymore, and we can have some conversations and engagements from this point on. And who is going to look after that?
I'll run the mic around.
Okay, run the mic around.
So say we're in a real conservative church. People aren't used to dialoguing. They're used to being, an audience.
Yeah.
What suggestions do you have from these other churches that are beginning to dialogue,
right,
to hear each other's stories?
Sure.
What are they doing? How is that starting up?
Yeah. You're saying, if we're in a real conservative church where people are not used to dialoguing, they're basically, bums on a seat, passive, tell us. You don't change that. You keep doing it. But what you do is you find those, and they're going to be there, who who are sensing that there's a different level of conversation that needs to happen, and you create an experiment. Let's just create an experiment in this kind of dialogue, and you don't make it the program or this is the way the church is going to go. You keep doing all the things that you're doing, and you create this experiment. And you begin to reflect upon the experiment, and what you find is that it invites others in. That's how you start doing it. Does that answer your question? Yeah. This is a, in the best sense of emergent language, this is a bottom-up process. And so you begin small and inconspicuous. I don't mean you don't tell people, but you say, let's try some things. One of the, Daryl and I were talking about this, that I think one of the most difficult things that can happen in many of our churches, particularly conservative churches, is to create an environment where it's okay to fail. And there's all kinds of reasons why we don't do that. But we don't have environments in our churches where it's okay to fail. But we will never hear what the Spirit's up to unless we can risk and fail. That's the only way we learn. So experimenting begins to create that kind of environment.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by your idea of having sort of bubbles or groups all over the place. How do you kind of network those together? How do you manage them without managing them?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
You mentioned when you were on the Danforth that if you were to do it over again,
yes,
you would create groups all over the neighborhood.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Of small groups meeting together here and there that would really be the church.
Yeah.
How do you build that network, and I mean, how do you sort of make that work without over-managing it? How do you empower them and yet still keep them connected?
Okay. The being connected, I'm trying to find the best way to describe how, because one of the things I would want to say, it happens. And I think what you're getting at is that this kind of sort of creative piece, you have to hold it loosely, but you have to hold it.
Right.
And so the question, what does the holding look like? You create, I mean, I've written about this in some other places a long time ago, and I'm trying to say, there's a way to look at it. There's both what I would call a bounded set and a centered set community, so that if I were doing it today, I would say what binds us together are certain things that we confess and certain practices that we do. Outside of that, you're constantly creating all kinds of environments for people to practice and experiment. And so for me, if I were doing it today, there are some very basic confessions that say, this is who we are. This gives us identity. And there are certain kinds of practices that shape us, whether they're liturgies or tables or what. And so you build it around that. Now, it's also a very informal process. It's not kind of loosey-goosey, everybody does what they want, but neither is it an organization where you have lots of rules. You know, here are all the rules, this is the way you do it. It requires a lot of interactive engagement from leaders, which is far more conversational and dialogical around both confession and practice. So, for example, I'll give you a very simple illustration of this. If you... In England, there is something called the Northumbria Community. And they live out of, this is a Protestant order that lives out of a rule of life. So, for example, Benedictines live out of an order of life, which is essentially to be a people of prayer and to practice hospitality. Now, they do that inside a confession, right? But outside of that, there's huge liberty. So that's the kind of thing that you need. And in a, and I think these are good illustrations, in a monastery, the abbot is not there to say, these are the rules, these are the policies and procedures that we ought to live by. The abbot is there to say, how are we doing in the light of our rule of life? So that's kind of a bounded set with a sentence. Am I answering your question?
Can you help me understand how you would define neighborhood? Is it just geography? Would other factors define a neighborhood? In particular, I'm in a community that has 30,000. Does it have one neighborhood, or does it get broken down?
Well, depends where you are. I mean, that. My first answer is depends where you are. So let me come into this one this way. I think part of the the ways in which, let me use theological language, the principalities and powers in late modernity exhibit themselves is the way in which everything, whether objects or human beings, get commodified. We become things that get bought and sold. And the way in which you create commodities, particularly out of human beings, is you disconnect them from primary social relationships, in which space and location become irrelevant. So, for example, you hear lots of conversations today that we can connect with each other in cyberspace, which we can do, but that becomes the reality. Or that neighborhood really doesn't matter anymore because we can drive 20 miles to be with the people that we want. I think if Christians are to be a society that lives as a sign and witness of what God is up to, we've got to rediscover geography, space, location. And that means neighborhood. So I think at the top I am saying neighborhood, like Orthodox Jews, is about 10 or 15 minutes walk from where you worship. Now that sounds crazy and radical. But the implication of that, if you begin to live into it, the implication of that is that your social networks start to get thick in an area. Now, I grew up in one of those as a kid in Liverpool, and I've got to tell you what that means to be a little boy and a teenager. It means that you're known and you're in relationships. And you see, the tragedy of the late modern West is that most relationships are atomized and broken apart. So, number one, I'm saying, yeah, neighborhood needs to become again where we live and pitch our tent. My concern is that if we start to define neighborhood as the social networks where we gather, all right, what you're really talking about is massive homogeneity, simply meeting with people like you. And again, that is counter to the gospel. It's counter to the imagination that God builds into the very nature of social relationships. Now, we're a million miles from that, a huge distance from that. But that's what I mean by neighborhood, and that's what I think is required. Now, how do you do that? For example, I'm working with a Presbyterian church in the U.S., 1,800 members, which 25 years ago was a church for its neighborhood. Now, all the upper middle class white folk who make up that church are scattered all over the place, all right? And they drive in to this church to get the religious goods and services. And by the way, in that same city, they took me to the happening emergent church. And when I went there with all everything else, people were driving 20 miles into that one too, you know? So what do you do in that kind of situation? You reimagine what it means. And so instead of seeing this church as the place y'all come and this is where everything happens, you begin to see it much like the medieval cathedrals were, as a ground in which you resource people to be God's people in their neighborhoods. Or in Kansas City, for example, Tim Keel, who runs Jacob's Well, which is now a church of 1,000 to 1,500 people, 30 years of age and under, what Tim is doing is saying, if we are going to be salt and light in this city, we've got to recover, now this is an evangelical, the notion of parish. And so what he's doing, because he's, you know, younger guy, using technology to locate his people and begin to say, this is where you need to pitch your tent and settle in and be God's people. So that's literally what I'm meaning by neighborhood. But behind it, there's a whole sense of what's God up to in creation? What does it mean to be social community? How do you reweave the fabric of social life in North America? My fear is that we keep creating churches that accelerate the fraying and the breaking of social life because we all get in cars and drive 10 or 15 miles to our kind of church. I'm sorry, I started to preach.
It's a really simple question here. It may be not a simple answer, but how do you balance the whole, you know, use the word conversation.
Right.
And I think when you come out of the Christendom model, you still come out of the proclamation
right.
era. So
yeah.
how do you balance or teach the art of conversation
right.
in a proclamation-oriented congregation? And also, you also talked about coming not from a place of power.
Yeah.
Which I think you deal with in your book on liminality, which
right.
is, I mean, I think it's a great concept, but I think a lot of us want to come from that place of power because, you know, realize, you know, well, we serve a very powerful God and he's, and we have the truth, and that big T truth kind of gets in the way of us relinquishing some of that in favor of starting conversations.
Right.
And so how does that all work for you?
Sure. Did everybody hear that question? Actually, there were about six questions, right? Yeah. Part of it is, I think, and tell me if I'm wrong, if you're functioning in a church where people are expecting from you the big T truth every Sunday, wrapped up in certain kinds of propositions, what do you do? Let me test this and see out of my own experience. I think there's several things. One is that most people these days, I think, are actually, and I just want to put, they're actually looking for the opposite. They're looking for you to preach things that give them an experience. So it's either experience or propositional truth. But you're asking about the propositional truth? What those kind of people often expect is, for them, the Bible is truth. So the first thing that's important is, and appropriate, is always, 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 particularly in preaching and conversation, go to the biblical text. Make the biblical text the core of the conversation. Live out of the biblical text. But then it becomes, how do you do that? In what ways do you live out of the biblical text? So let me give you illustrations of how I did it and see if it connects and makes sense. I would, when I was preaching when I was in West Vancouver, when I was preaching, I basically did it this way. I hung out at the places where most of my people hung out, which on the West Coast is the coffee shops. So we have a place in West Van called Bean Around the World, which, great coffee. The church, that's where the church is at 7 o'clock in the morning. And so when I was pastor there, I'd kiss Jane goodbye at 6:45 when she headed off to the school, and I'd go to Bean Around the World. And every single day, from about 7:15 to about 8-ish, I was at Bean Around the World. When it was time to write a sermon, I went to Bean Around the World, sat on the deck or sat in the coffee shop, and I'd write my sermons so that I was constantly in conversation with people. Now, why did I do that? Because I'm working with the text, and the text is story and narrative, not propositions. We may have a conversation about that in a sec, but that's fine. So what I do on a Sunday morning is, and you obviously don't do this full on first week, you move into this, I get up on a Sunday morning and I would say, I was at the Bean this week. And as soon as I said that, they knew that I knew their stories. They knew that this wasn't about some airy-fairy idea about sanctification, justification, or how to make your marriage work. And I'd tell a story about somebody I was in conversation with at the Bean. I wouldn't give away who it was, but I'd tell a story. I could still remember lots of them. And then I would connect that story to the text, to the biblical story. But I would never connect it in a way that said, now here's the biblical story, and it's the answer to what was going on at Bean Around the World, and because it's the answer, here are three things that you could do. What I always did was go, here's this story, which means you know my life. Now here's this biblical story. Now look at how this biblical story messes with this story from Bean Around the World. And I would never give an answer. Here's what happened. I spend the rest of my week at Bean Around the World having conversations with people who on a Sunday morning says, I got to talk to you. And that's where the dialogue took place, because it was their stories. You know? Now, I didn't dive into that first time I was there. I set it up. I did a series so that they heard, I think with integrity, what for them was a normal, formal way of teaching. But then gradually I began to do this, you see. And here's my, I mean, I suspect there are some churches that might fire you for doing that, but probably not many of them. Am I getting at what you're asking? So you've got to iterate the dialogue. It's like, it's not a technique. It's a way of sensing, where are these people? Where are my people? So that it's how these stories are intersecting. What, I don't want to get into a preaching thing, but too often in conservative churches, it's one of two things. We feel we've got to teach the right truths so people have it, without realizing that today they don't have anything when you do that. Or we've got to give them sort of how to make life work. If I sat down with a friend of mine who was preaching on the book of Ruth, and he started off by describing this gorgeous story and then saying to everybody, there are three principles in this book that make every effective marriage work, and here's what they are. Now, I tell you what, I won't tell you what I wanted to do, but I sat there. But afterwards, I sat down in front of him, and I said, don't you be such a blank, 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 blank. That is the most destructive, undermining way to engage the biblical text. How dare you do that to a story that is about how God works amongst the outsider and those that we throw on the trash heap, women and Gentiles, and brings about God's future? That's not a story on how to make my marriage work. It's a radically different story. But that's what we do. As evangelicals, we either keep to the propositions or we want to say, how do we use this text to give people help to live? And I want to tell you, if people want help to live, all they need to do is put Oprah on or Dr. Phil, and they'll get a heck of a lot better help to live than what preaches most Sunday mornings, because that's not what the biblical story is about. And people know that. So I think when you start connecting these things, you'll be amazed at the people that want to have coffee with you. Now, your board might want to have coffee with you for a different reason, but that's another issue.
I had a question about the conversation you had in the Missional Leader about the nature of change having changed. And I was interested in your concept of discontinuous change. And since you kind of have labeled that and have been exploring that, can you tell us a few more stories of moments when you've seen discontinuous change and communities that have responded to that? Kind of unpack that a little bit.
Does everybody know when we talk about discontinuous change what we're talking about? Okay. The simple ways to describe it are that, I mean, change, there's nothing new about change. Change is always going on. In the biblical stories, for example, a good example of discontinuous change over against continuous change is that prior to, for example, the exile in 587 BC, life went on real well in Jerusalem. And sort of play with the text a little bit, people in Jerusalem would, go to church with the Torah under their arms. Actually, they wouldn't, but anyway, let's play this. Every Saturday, and the buildings were full, and they might sort of change the psalm that they sang, or the priest might get a new gown. But over the generations, things changed gradually, but basically each built upon the next. And then discontinuous change was when Nebuchadnezzar comes in and basically levels Jerusalem, levels the temple, and takes the best and the brightest, 500-600 miles to Babylon. Why is that discontinuous? For those folk, a world in which they lived and made sense has been ripped away from them, and they're put in a world for which they've never been prepared and doesn't make sense. So that's an example of discontinuous change. So where is this at work and being seen? It's difficult to say here in this church is a particular example of this, but let me give you some illustrations and stories. I'll give you a really good one, actually. I'm not saying this to brag, but it was so obvious. I was in Sydney, Australia, working with some Anglican churches in which the pastors were complaining that their people were no longer faithful, and they couldn't get people to come to the programs. And that, you know, on a Sunday morning, it was, here's all the programs, here's what we want you to join, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not just Anglicans. It's very interesting. I find it very interesting because I travel a lot to sit in a Sunday service in a church and listen to the announcement times. Because in my experience, most of the announcement times are the wonderful opportunities that I have to do things in that church and people announcing about it. So here are these Anglican pastors complaining that their people are just not faithful anymore. And so I thought, it's time to give these guys, because they were all guys, an experience in discontinuous change. So I said to them, all right, since this is a 3-day course, tomorrow morning I want you to meet me at the train station at 6:30 in the morning. That in itself was discontinuous change. And so we got on a train at 6:30 in the morning, and it was packed with people, men and women dressed in business suits and dresses, heading to downtown Sydney, because we were out near Botany Bay by the airport in a place called the Shire. And we go down about a 40-minute train ride into the city, get there about 7:15-ish, everybody disgorges. And they're saying to me, why are we doing this? And so then we do, you know, the typical, let's do the city, talk about the architecture, talk about what's going on, and we're going to catch the train back at 6 o'clock at night. So we got on the train at 6 o'clock at night, and most of the people who were on it at 6 o'clock in the morning are on the train. But instead of bright, bushy-eyed, and wide-awake reading their newspapers, they're on the train, and they just look like wilted balloons, leaning like this, and they get off the train at 7 o'clock. And I gather these pastors who now want to go home and pray and say to them, these are your people. Now think for a minute. When you ask them to volunteer for a program on a Wednesday night or a Sunday morning or a weekend, The discontinuous change here is that the ways we've constructed church were built around a variety of things. One is it was built around a society in which most of the working adults had time to volunteer and do church. And that does not exist anymore. That's gone, absolutely gone. So how do you begin to engage that kind of world? So let me give you an illustration. Again, something. I'm not trying to do this to do. I'm not trying to do this to advertise. But you can get this off the Alelon website. It's a video that Bill did. A friend of mine is caught up in this kind of world. Busy, 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 and he's doing all the church stuff. And this is about neighborhood. Whoever asked the question. And what he's doing is he goes to this big church in the city and he takes his kids to Christian schools and the kids are involved in Little League, Big League, In and Out League and whatever. And he's discovering that he and his wife are on the road all the time and then volunteering for the big programs in the church. Well, I probably don't have to tell some of you what it's like. Getting the kids ready and into cars is hell on earth. And you're driving all over the place. Mark describes how one day after hell on earth, he drives and he realizes that every time he drives out of his neighborhood, half the other people are driving out of the same neighborhood to their thousand things and their different churches, and nobody in the neighborhood has time to talk to people across the street or around the corner. And so this one particular morning, he's driving along, the kids are screaming, he pulls the car over and he says, "It's finished." And the kids look with this terrible look. Basically, he turns the car around, goes home and says, "We're done." And he pulls his kids out of the Christian schools, out of all the programs. He pulls out of the big church that he's going to and the board that he's on, and he says, "We are going to camp out and pitch our tent in this place where we live that we never see." And when he starts to do that, he begins to notice that in this place, in this neighborhood, the schools, and there's nothing for kids to do. And it's basically kind of a suburb with a crossroad, and nobody connects. And so he, with some others, take an old Baptist church that nobody's using, move it onto a lot, and create a coffee house. I mean, what's the coffee house called?
Rembrandt.
Called Rembrandt's. And this coffee house is to become a gathering place for the community. Okay? Now, this is discontinuous change at work. But what does it come out of? It comes out of beginning to say, can't live like this anymore. This mad life of, basically I've described it, and beginning to settle down where you live and look around and say, what's going on here? And a bunch of them begin to say, let's create a coffee house. Now please, this is my fifth illustration of coffee houses. I come from the Pacific Northwest. There is God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and coffee. And then there's my wife and kids and grandkids. That's the order of things. I'm just kidding. The coffee houses are not the answer. And so this becomes a gathering place. And out of that, they then begin, they can begin to create all kinds of things. So here is, and Bill has this on video. Here now is a gal, woman in her 50s, who used to be one of the key leaders with her husband in the vineyard, who has, like huge numbers of adults, given up on the church, sitting and working with kids at risk in the neighborhood, big, burly kids teaching them to cook, and loving it. And alive in Christ all over again. Now, why did that happen? This is discontinuous change. It was a recognition that you can't live this way anymore. Let's try some new things. And out of that, now, what you'll see if you look at that video is that, and this is about how do you deal with discontinuous change, this did not come out of some big plan. Nobody sat down and began to map, these are all the things that we're going to do. It came out of saying, we just can't live in those ways anymore. We don't know what we're going to do, but we're going to start here. Now let's begin to discover. Does that help?
This Leilan Netcast, produced in cooperation with Resonate.ca, continues in part 2.